This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Gary native and Olympic great Diane Durham was the first African-American senior national gymnastics champion. Earlier this year, she passed away following a short but hard-fought battle against illness. City of Gary spokesman Michael Gonzalez guest hosts an episode of Off Mic this summer and spoke with her husband, Tom Jehozal, about her legacy and how she paved the way for many of the superstar athletes that we see today. And here's the conversation.
Over the last few Summer Olympic Games, I've been really excited to see so much more racial and ethnic diversity in so many sports. And I see it a lot in U.S. women's gymnastics. Athletes like Lori Hernandez and Gabby Douglas, Sunisa Lee, and Simone Biles have redefined the sport in the U.S., but they can all thank trailblazers like Lucy Collins, Dominique Dawes, Kyla Ross, and one special person I'd like to talk about today, and that's Gary's own Diane Durham. Tom Jehozal is joining us. He's a high school principal, coach, and the husband of Diane Durham, who helped change the face of gymnastics in 1983 when she became the first African-American woman to win the U.S. National Gymnastics Championship. A year later, Diane was denied a spot at the 1984 Olympic team due to injury and a controversial ruling on her petition to be included on the U.S. team. This year, she was posthumously inducted into U.S. Gymnastics Hall of Fame. She went on to become a professional gymnastics performer, a coach, a motivational speaker, and a gym owner. Unfortunately, Diane passed away in February after a brief illness. She was 52. Tom Jehozal, thank you for joining us on Off Mic. First, my condolences to you and your loved ones.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you for joining us. Today marks your 27th anniversary, yours and Diane, and I know it takes a tremendous amount of courage and love to share her story this way.
Yeah, it does, but I do think it's of value for Diane's story to be told so future generations realize the impact she had on the sport of gymnastics.
And it's an amazing story, Tom, but before we begin, I have to ask you, I'm curious, how does a high school teacher meet and marry a trailblazing world-class athlete like Diane Durham?
Well, Diane had just finished performing. Diane did get to the Olympics, a little bit different path than she expected to. She performed in the closing ceremonies of the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona. So she, on that flight back, she'd been doing a lot of professional dance shows. She'd been all over the world. She'd been in Spain with Barcelona for that. She'd been to Japan, and she'd been in Germany for different shows. And on the way back, she told me she had decided she was looking to settle down. She was kind of tired of the dance audition life of, you know, it's pretty much, you know, you're here today, and then once that show goes, it's find the next show. So she said on the way back, she decided she was going to settle down. She took a gymnastics coaching job in Chicago at the time. And so I met her when we were both out one night, and then, you know, 6 months after we met, we got engaged. A year and a half later, we were married.
Oh, that's a beautiful story. And she was very busy, and she had a lot of titles. I mean, she earned her titles and accolades. For all those titles, what do you think, what title or accomplishment do you think she cherished the most?
I mean, I think of all the gymnastics-wise, there were two meets to her, or there were actually three big meets to her that stuck out. One was, of course, winning senior USA all-around championship in Chicago because it was so close to Gary where she grew up. Mm-hmm. And the fan base from Gary that turned out for that event, I think that really meant a lot to her as well. That's something she always talked about. 1983, also, she competed in what was the pre-Olympic Games, which were in Los Angeles in Pauley Pavilion, where those games would be held in 1984, and she won the all-around championship in that competition, and she beat gymnasts from Soviet bloc countries who would later boycott the 1984 Olympics.
So those videos.
The last one to her was the Sanlam Cup in South Africa in 1981, where she won the all-around championship during apartheid in South Africa. That was her first international trip.
These are all so amazing. I really enjoy watching the videos, by the way. And there are these large We Love Diane signs that they're holding up in the stands. It was just such a fantastic and energizing moment.
And that was from her church back in Gary, actually, that people did that.
So Gary came out. So I know that growing up, for me anyways, it was rare, as I mentioned a moment ago, to see people of color competing on U.S. teams in a whole lot of sports. That's clearly changing. And I think Diane's accomplishments had a lot to do with that. So how do you think, how did Diane see gymnastics over the last few years, especially when you compare it to gymnastics when she was growing up?
Well, that's true. Gymnastics, there was more artistry involved in it today than there was back in Diane's era than it is today. In the reward, the scoring system, it was a 10 scoring system, and today there is a reward for difficulty, you know, plus artistry type of execution as well. So it is different from what it used to be in her era. I do feel, and, you know, a lot of people have said the same thing, that between Diane and Mary Lou Retton, they kind of introduced, you know, power gymnastics to not only the United States, but later to the world as well.
Now, I think, isn't it the case also that Diane was the last person to beat Mary Lou Retton in an all-around competition?
Yes, she was. Yeah, and that was at those pre-Olympic games in 1983.
And by the way, in one of those videos, I'm watching Diane do the uneven bars, and she hits her left ankle. I think it was her left or right ankle, but she hit one of her ankles on the bars. And she just continued. She carried on, and when she was being interviewed afterwards, she said, "Oh no, it's not really a problem. It's not an injury. Not really an injury." Even though Bella Caroli is kind of massaging out that injury, so it speaks to her toughness.
It does, and then, because she did tell me, I know I'm not the gymnastics expert, but I remember that move. She told me she would hit her heel a lot on the bars, so that was something she had kind of gotten accustomed to, because the bars were much closer together mm-hmm. back in that era than they are today as well.
So, you know, we talk about how gymnastics and other sports have changed. What's it going to take? So what do you think it'll take to get more young boys and girls of color into and competing at such high level of gymnastics and other sports? Clearly, when you have trailblazers like Diane Durham, that's got to be a big help. But what else is it going to take?
Well, I mean, it takes, you know, as far as there's got to be an investment in at the ground level, you know, in communities across the United States to get kids into gymnastics. It's an expensive sport. That's part of the problem. So in the inner cities, there's got to be the cities, you know, have to help finance through park district type programs or getting people, you know, to contribute to introduce gymnastics in urban areas, I think would be a big plus to it. Obviously, you know, from Diane's era, however, you know, the amount of minority gymnasts competing in the sport has grown dramatically, though, too. And that's something you can see at all different levels. And when I would go along to Diane with meets, when she was either judging or had gymnasts competing, you did see there was much more of a diverse look in the program as far as the Junior Olympic competitions that she was judging or coaching in.
You know, I want to talk a little bit more, especially about the financial accessibility of this sport, but it strikes me as you and Diane were traveling and you go to different places, you just had to be just surrounded by people who wanted to just talk to her and kind of have a moment with her and just show her some love. Tell me about those moments.
Well, definitely when you know, at gymnastics competitions or conferences, definitely, I mean, Diane was very, you know, people did recognize her. So, and that was always something that she did appreciate, that people still remembered her contribution to the sport, you know, so many years after she had competed. So that was something that, you know, did stick with her, and it did make her realize that she did make a difference in the sport as well.
Is there a particular moment that touched you in one of those times? Is there something that really grabs your attention even now?
The one thing that would happen is kind of she couldn't understand like why little gymnasts sometimes would always remember who she was or ask her for her autograph or want to take a picture with her. And then because she would tell me that as we were, you know, leaving the venue or walking back to the hotel. And I would always tell her, it's like, Diana said, you have to remember, I said, those parents, the parents of those gymnasts are the ones that remember who you are. And then that would kind of click into her and let her realize that, you know, obviously she made an impact on those parents so much that, you know, they're pointing her out to their children as well.
So when you meet people and they find out you're married to Diane, and what are some of the ways you describe her? How do you describe her? Because, I mean, 27 years, it's a long time. 26, 27 years is a long time. What's sort of the first things that come out of your heart and your mind when you think about describing Diane?
Well, I mean, gymnastics-wise, she loved gymnastics. And even though she felt at times the gymnastics some of the powers to be in the gymnastics world didn't love her as much as she loved the sport. She always loved gymnastics. That was kind of an undying love that she had. Outside of gymnastics, she had a very charismatic, outgoing personality. When Diane may have been small in stature, she was, 5'1", but when she walked in a room, everybody knew, Diane Durham was in the room.
Sure.
I mean, she definitely had a very bubbly, energetic, positive personality.
So if we come back to talking a little bit about gymnastics and how expensive it is, it really is. I mean, people move across country to train. So even if you get communities involved, how does this sport become more financially accessible to more people?
Well, I think once you get to the elite level, Diane left Gary to go train in Texas with Bella Caroli, and she did that in 1982, I believe. So, it is kind of, there are pockets when you want to get to that elite level, there's certain gyms that you end up having to go to, because Diane's gymnastics career started at Wanda's gym in Gary. And then Wanda later moved to Merrillville, but then Wanda Tomasi. And then Wanda basically, when Diane got to such a high level, Wanda told Diane, I can no longer coach you. You're an Olympic caliber athlete, which, hats off to Wanda for saying that, instead of trying to, and so that was a huge thing. And then after that, Diane was traveling into Illinois all the way up to like Northbrook to train or into the south suburbs, southwest suburbs. So it was quite a commute for her, 5-6 days a week to go to basically after school, get in the car with her mom, and then, she'd go work out and then come back home at night.
That's just an incredible commitment and sacrifice.
By her and her family both.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And speaking of
family.
Her dad's
listening today, so, he definitely had a role in it.
Well, hi, Dad. We're just honored to be able to talk about Diane Durham today on Off Mic. So, Tom Trajosa, tell me about the Diane Durham Humanitarian Award.
Okay, that is something. It's a GoFundMe that started under the GoFundMe. If you look up Diane Durham Humanitarian Award, it was started by Paul Zert, actually. Paul Zert was Bart Conner's former coach. He is now his business manager and with Nadia Comaneci as well. Diane performed in, hundreds of gymnastics professional shows with Paul Zert and Bart Conner and then Nadia Comaneci as well. And so they remained friends, all the way up until Diane's passing. So Diane knew them, from the 1980 all the way up until, for over 40 years. And Paul wanted this way to honor Diane, to preserve her legacy, so people would know about her and future generations would as well. And the idea behind this, and Diane's sister Alice and myself are going to be, we're involved with that and on the board of directors and helping to, select who the winners will be, is to honor a gymnast who has kind of had to overcome, some issues in their life, whether it's injuries or social emotional issues, and they would be the recipient of the Diane Durham Humanitarian Award. We want to make this an annual award as well. It's already raised over $30,000.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, so we're hoping to continue to see that number continue to grow so we can, so their awards every year could be bigger, but also so we can continue to grow this award as well.
And so where do folks go if they want more information or if they want to contribute?
If you want to contribute, you just literally, if you do a search for the Diane Durham Humanitarian Award, it's a GoFundMe link, and it'll take you right to it.
So real quick, we've just got about a minute and a half or so, but you're a basketball coach and a baseball coach. You've earned your chops as a coach. Real quick, what traits do you see in young people that stand out to you and you can say, hey, that kid's got some talent? You've been working with kids for a long time.
Yes, I have. The biggest thing you see is, the inner drive themselves. You as a coach can try and pull things out of a student, out of an athlete, but which is helpful, but they've also got to want to have that drive as well. And when they have that, you can see some wonderful things take place.
Well, that with great coaching helps a lot too. So that, Tom Trajosa, you've been extremely generous with your time. Thank you for sharing this wonderful story with us on Off Mic.
And I appreciate you taking the time to recognize Diane as well.
It's really my honor and my pleasure.
That was the City of Gary spokesman, Michael Gonzalez, guest hosting on Off Mic, speaking with Tom Trajosa, who's the husband of the late, great gymnast Diane Durham last summer. The family of the late champion gymnast and Gary native, Diane Durham, will host a celebration of life on Saturday, November 6th at 3 p.m. at Westside Leadership Academy Auditorium, which is at 900 Gary Street in Gary. And Durham passed away back in February because of a short illness, but the celebration of life was delayed because of the pandemic. The events, by the way, is free and open to the public. Attendees for the memorial service are asked to RSVP by October 29th by searching for the Diane Durham Celebration of Life on Facebook or by email to tomdi94@cs.com. This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Alex Kukulka is the Lake County government reporter and covers other stories, too, here in the region for the Post Tribune. And she's with us today to talk about the stories she has out there in print and online. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, one of the big stories you've had out there talks about the fellow who is in charge of the Lake County 911 department, Mark Swiderski. Tell us what Mark is in trouble for and why he is on suspension these days.
He was suspended effective October 18th for 30 days without pay from the Lake County 911 department because the Lake County Board of Commissioners conducted an investigation and found that he has violated some like portions of the Lake County employee handbook. They wouldn't tell me which ones when I asked, but they found enough to say that he did, and so he's been suspended for 30 days without pay. Through November 15th is sort of the date right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, so all we know right now is that some kind of personnel decision. There's a personnel decision by at least the county commissioners. We understand. So there's no problem as far as the operation of the department itself. It's running very well with, I guess, his deputy, isn't it?
Yeah, they said that the department's still operational, and then if there were to be some major emergency, he's still sort of available to step in or give support. But as of now, it's all running smoothly while he's on suspension.
Okay. I know in your story you talk in more detail about some of the issues that the Emergency Services Department with Lake County government has had in the past, and he has brought up some of these issues as well in some of the past conversations. Will you tell us a little bit about what Mark Swiderski has been concerned about and some of the issues at least he's tried to deal with?
Yeah, so he's discussed a lot about the difficulties in sort of keeping the dispatchers on the job because of the long hours, the stress of receiving these calls from people who are, you know, facing a very challenging moment in that moment. And also the wage for the position isn't as ideal given the amount of stress that they put up with. So he said there's a lot of turnover for a lot of those three reasons. COVID-19 hit the department pretty hard. They had, at least as of December, he told me that there were 27 employees who tested positive for coronavirus, which then meant that 100 overall had to quarantine in some way, shape, or form, be that, you know, close contact or actually testing positive. So he's been requesting a lot of transfers for overtime to cover and make up that difference or, you know, to make up the people who were off. So it's definitely been, at least the pandemic months have been extra challenging given those circumstances.
I understand, too, it's not only because of the pandemic that people aren't able to work for whatever reason, but even just having trouble trying to find enough people to staff the department, I understand, too.
Yeah. So even outside of COVID, they have 105 employees is like the max they have. And they seem to lately have been in like the 90-person range, mid-90s in employees. So they tend to be not fully staffed even outside of the pandemic. So it definitely has been challenging to hire and train the dispatchers.
One of the other stories that you had out there in print and online that people can check on is another story that's coming out of the Lake County Commissioners, and it's about the American Rescue Plan Act funds that Lake County government's going to be getting. They're getting about, what, $94 million plus in what they're expecting, and they have some ideas at least how they're going to spend a good chunk of that money, and that's, in fact, in your story. Will you fill us in on that?
Yeah, so the county is going to receive $94.3 million, roughly, I'm rounding here, money through the American Rescue Plan Act. They've already received about $47.2 million, and then they're going to receive the rest of it in 2022. But they are focusing on two major sewer projects, one in Calumet Township and one in Center Township. That's where the big bulk of the money is going to go. Calumet Township, that project alone, the first phase of it is slated to cost $42 million. And then the Center Township one is slated to cost $25 million. And then they're saving $27 million in contingencies in case, you know, like cost of material increases in the next year or cost of labor, whatever it might be. They sort of are padding that a little bit. And they do acknowledge that that is a lot to have in sort of a side amount, but they're just trying to be prepared. And then if that money isn't spent for these two projects, it would go towards different projects throughout the county. But I am sort of being reassured by the commissioners that the way they're looking at it is that a very big portion, if not all of this money, is going to go towards these two sewer projects. So.
And from the people that you've talked to, mainly the county commissioners, and being at some of the meetings or where they've discussed the issues, what's have been the concerns that county officials have had that have led to the septic systems apparently causing enough problems that there's a health concern that's in certain parts of the county? And that's, I'm sure, why part of this comes up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Calumet Township project is sort of the main big project where a lot of the money's going to go. And apparently, since 1991, there's been near over 300 complaints about septic systems in the area. And they hired an engineering company and other professionals who, in like the 2017-2018 timeframe, did a study of the Caddy Marsh Ditch. And they found elevated levels of E. coli and other contaminants there because of the failing septic systems. Which when runoff happens, it's sort of, that's how it hits that water source. So they are super concerned about being able to address this and fix this because that the water then sort of is there. And yeah, so they want to address that, the contaminant issue. And they do say the first phase of the project covers 700 acres and that more than 900 residential and business units would be impacted, or like, you know, the systems would improve. So they're pretty they're looking forward to that first phase because it covers a good portion of the project right there.
Now, I understand, and for our listeners' benefit, if they're not familiar with the area, we're talking this in the section of Calumet Township. We're basically talking about the unincorporated section that is from the Griffith town limits all the way to the east, I think to Cleveland Street. Almost to the Gary city limits. It's a stretch that's basically out in the country, or if it were out in the country, it would be out in the country. But a lot of people live there, and a lot of people, unfortunately, because they've been living there for decades, they're on septic tanks rather than on sewers. Mm-hmm. Now, I know there are also some other areas, too. Center Township is another region. What got the county commissioners interested in wanting to improve the sewers, or rather put in sewers to improve the situation out there?
Yeah, so that project, they identified seven subdivisions that should be like improved, or that could be improved, and they're going to focus on five right now. So they're still sort of laying out that plan of it. They're still trying to determine how to approach those subdivisions, but that's what they are that they're focusing on that first phase. I apologize. They identified nine subdivisions.
Oh, okay.
And they're focusing on five. My apologies.
Okay.
So they identified nine subdivisions in Center Township that have water system issues, and they are going to look at five right now as part of this plan as highest priority. But they're still sort of determining the details of that with other officials in the area. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like that at least they will try and do the other areas if they have the funds available to do it. So they're not giving up on the rest of them, to be sure. So that's good to know. Mm-hmm. One other story that you had out there in print in the Post Tribune and online as well on the website talks about the new state senator that is somebody chosen here recently to take the place of the retiring Karen Talion. Will you tell us more about what the new person who's going to be taking that position, in fact, gets to go to Indianapolis for the organization day very soon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Rodney Pohl Jr., who's the corporation counsel for the city of Gary, he won a caucus last Thursday to replace Senator Karen Talion for the 4th District in the Indiana Senate. And she, Karen Talion, after 16 years, announced that she's going to resign. So that's why he's going to fill, Mr. Pohl is going to fill in that last year of her term. And then the seat will be up for election again. But he did win in a caucus against 5 candidates who ran against him. And the caucus covered the precincts in LaPorte and Porter County that the district covers. And all 94 the precinct committee chair people were invited to vote in the caucus. And ultimately, 56 people showed up out of the 94 for that first round of voting. And the way to win is to receive 50% plus one vote for those who showed up to vote. And they basically had rounds of voting until someone received that 50% plus one. So there were 2 rounds of voting in Mr. Pohl's case. And he won on the 2nd round when there were 54 voters left, 2 people left after that first round, which is allowed. So there were 54 voters on that 2nd round, and he won the 50% plus one. So that makes him the new senator.
And I understand Rodney comes very well recommended for the position.
Yeah. Karen Talion has been supporting him. She met with him a few weeks before the caucus. She actually attended the caucus because she's a precinct committee chairperson. So that was, she was able to go and vote. They honored her as well before the vote to thank her for her service. She got roses from the committee people who were there. And yeah, she voiced her support for him and said that he would make a great candidate. And then Mike Schmull, who's the Indiana Democratic Party chairman, he also said he was excited about how energetic and young and just excited that Mr. Pohl is to take over the position. The Porter County Democratic chairman, he was also very excited about his winning the caucus. So, yeah, he's got a lot of support in his corner.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how Rodney Pohl Jr. does as he becomes a new Indiana state senator here in Northwest Indiana. And as I mentioned, it won't be very long before Organization Day for the next General Assembly session is being held. And so he'll be able to go down to Indianapolis for that. And we'll look forward to finding out more about the new members of the Indiana legislature when they show up in the session. Alex Kukulka is a reporter for the Post Tribune. She covers mainly Lake County government issues, but she covers other stories as well, including the story about someone who's going to take the spot of Senator Karen Talion. Alex, thank you very much for being with us today, and I hope to have you back on again soon.
Thank you so much.
Continuing on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's talk to Joseph Pete. He's the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And nice to talk with you again, Joe.
Oh, nice to talk with you.
Well, yeah, some interesting stories out. In fact, important stories. In this case, we're talking first here, of course, about the information that came out from Maryville-based NIPSCO. They've kind of refined their plans for how they're going to look to the future of electric generation here in Northwest Indiana. And one of those is an update on how long the Michigan City Generating Station is going to be open. Will you fill us in what NIPSCO has to say and some of their plans?
Oh, absolutely. They have updated their 2021 Integrated Resource Plan, which is kind of their future plan for their energy portfolio and electricity generation. They announced a couple of different tweaks and changes. They're making like a pretty much wholesale change recently from, they've been retiring a lot of their coal-fired electricity generation. Almost all of the coal-fired at Schaefer will be retired by 2023. but they are switching to more solar and wind and renewable and buying energy off of the spot market and meeting consumers' energy needs that way with a more renewable approach that with fewer fossil fuels and not contributing to global warming and climate change and everything. They have announced that they're going to be retiring one of their most kind of famous landmark plants, the Michigan City Generating Station on Lake Michigan and Michigan City. It was initially supposed to be retired by 2028. Now they're saying they might be able to retire it as much as 2 years earlier if the transition goes smoothly. They're setting their new target date between 2026 and 2028. It's going to free up a mile of lakeshore in Michigan City there that they're looking at turning into potentially parkland and or a trail on Lake Michigan. It was the site of the historic Hoosier Slide, which at one point was the tallest sand dune in all of Northwest Indiana. It was 200 feet high. Unfortunately, it was taken, you know, all the sand was removed largely by the Ball Corporation and Muncie. They turned it into ball jars that were sold around the country for years and years and years. They hauled all the sand out with locomotives and everything. A lot of it also went to, you know, to building foundations and parks in Chicago. Northerly Island, where there used to be the airport, that was entirely built out with sand hauled over from Michigan City from the Hoosier Slide. Mm-hmm. But that's been gone for some time, even though it was once the state's top tourist attraction, because you could see for miles around and people like to fly down and so forth, hence the name. But the NIPSCO built that plant there. It's often been compared to the plant from Simpson, because it has that hyperbolic cooling tower that leads a lot of people to erroneously believe it's like a nuclear power plant. It's not. It's powered by coal. You know, so a lot of some people consider it, including business owners downtown, consider it to be an eyesore. Some people kind of look at it as like a symbol of the city because, you know, once you're downtown, you can't really, it's hard to miss. The tower kind of looms over everything.
Yeah.
But it will be, it's obviously been very not environmentally friendly. It's burning coal in there, contributing to climate change. They will be, they do have plans to remove it, but they're just saying they might be able to accelerate it. They did announce some other plans, though, too. They're going to replace two of their gas peaking units at the R.M. Schaefer Generating Station in Jasper County with newer natural gas. I know environmental groups are not very happy about that. They're accused of backtracking on, you know, they talked about, you know, making this wholesale shift to renewables. There was some upset that they're going to stick with natural gas for a while in the Jasper County plant. And then they also said they haven't committed to it, but they said which they've been saying, is that they might experiment with hydrogen for terms of energy generation in the future, because they've been, as they retire coal and kind of wean mostly off natural gas, they've been looking at having a diverse portfolio of sources for energy generation. Like, a lot of it will be supplemented too by buying off the spot market, and there's no guarantee that that's also going to come from clean energy sources like solar and wind. But they've been investing in about 14 different projects currently, where they would build wind farms or solar installations downstate. A lot of it is not in Northwest Indiana. They are doing the Dunsbridge Solar Project in Jasper County, though. They got two phases of that planned out through 2023. But they are investing heavily in that right now as they're looking to kind of make this switch. But they are, they're also potentially looking at hydrogen projects of some sort. They're just looking for a diverse mix for their portfolio. A large part of it, too, is investing in storage, batteries, and then, you know, because the solar, it's one thing when the sun is out, but you need to kind of capture and store that energy so you can continue to use it while it's dark and everything. So a large part of it is looking at investing in storage facilities and battery technologies. But it's, they kind of are just updating their plan and consumers about where they're going to get the electricity going forward. They're still saying they're on track to reduce carbon emissions by about 90% from as compared to 2005 by 2030. So it's a pretty dramatic weaning off carbon generally for the utility.
Is NIPSCO due to have to turn this information over, the updated information, maybe we should say, to the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission for them to review and to put into effect?
Yes, they will. They don't require, they do require approval for anything that will affect rates.
Right.
Because it's a very heavily regulated industry because they have a monopoly, so there's no competitive, there's no competition to kind of drive down prices or ensure the consumers will be treated fairly. So, you know, anytime they do a big capital investment or or decide to raise or change rates in any way, it does require them to get state approval. I believe the state has approved pretty much the general outline of the plan that they're currently going. Like, they've had all these capital projects that they've got an approval for, and then they are, I'm not sure with this tweak if that will require them to submit anything.
Yeah.
But then also, too, with with the rate increases, at least, you know, they'll invest the money, and then they'll go to state regulators and say, well, we invested, you know, $300 million in, you know, updating the electrical grid, and it was necessary for these reasons, so now we need to raise rates to pay that off, and here's why, you know. So sometimes it's the kind of it's pretty much a guarantee that they're going to get whatever it is they're asking to pay for, because they've already sunk the money into it. So, but this is, they've been, part of their case for this is not just environmental. They're also arguing that a lot of the technology with the wind and solar, is it the case where it will enable them to provide electricity more cheaply to consumers, or most cheaply to consumers going forward? I mean, it's still going to increase over time.
Right.
And, you know, they still have to maintain the grid and everything. However, you know, you've been seeing natural gas has been cheap for years, and it's still cheap, which is why they're investing in it. But for coal, it's been getting more expensive because you've seen the wholesale shift worldwide from these dirtier energy sources to these cleaner energy sources. And what happens is, you know, over time, you increase the amount of wind and solar production, the technology gets better, it becomes more cost efficient, and it becomes, you know, cheaper to provide that. Whereas kind of the legacy, legacy energy sources such as coal become, you know, it might have been cheap like 100 years ago, but it's going to get more and more expensive now as fewer people are using it, and, you know, more and more of the production capacity goes offline. And that also doesn't allow them to react as quickly to fluctuations in demand and everything. So coal is only going to get more and more expensive. And a lot of the, you know, wind and solar and hydro and all these things are only going to get cheaper going forward. And so part of they're trying to be on the, they jumped earlier than a lot of the, like, Duke Energy and Indianapolis Power and Light and a lot of these other downstate Indiana utilities have been sticking more with, you know, some of their traditional power sources. But there's, you know, there's a seismic shift going on across America and across the world, and NIPSCO's kind of been looking to get out ahead of it and just ensure they're able to provide the most affordable power to customers.
One of the other stories that you've had out there in print and online too, Joe, is talking, I guess, an update on the Ford Chicago Assembly Plant over in the Hagwish neighborhood across the state line, and the Chicago Stamping Plant in Chicago Heights. And the UAW is sending out mailings to its members. Something interesting, maybe not a matter of a labor union issue, but it is something, I guess, about membership. Will you fill us in on that?
Sure, absolutely. There was a big corruption scandal from a couple of years ago where the president was removed, and there were, you know, alleged, like, bribe taking and misappropriation of union funds, taking kickbacks. A dozen different UAW officials ended up going to prison, including two of the former presidents. It was one of the biggest union scandals kind of in years. But a lot of that was kind of removed from local, you know, it was at the international level. It was a lot of the Detroit guys. But the as part of it, they reached a the UAW reached a overhaul agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice in court. They reached a settlement where part of it is that they would consider overhauling how they elect their leadership, which is, you know, theory, the argument is could potentially, you know, reduce corruption and the temptation of corruption and create kind of a more democratic system. So what they're doing now is, like, for a long time, they've elected their leadership at the international level via delegate system, where, you know, their votes at the it's removed from the voter. You know, you vote on delegations to send to constitutional conventions, and they in turn, you know, elect your leaders. What they're voting on now nationally is whether or not they're going to elect their leaders directly through a democratic vote. And, you know, advocates for this say, you know, it's gonna lead to fewer backroom deals. It's gonna be more open and transparent. It's gonna operate more like, you know, the democratic system we have. Some critics have, you know, suggested, well, you know, it's potentially gonna still be open to corruption because, you know, these candidates still need to raise funds and, you know, so forth. But the ballots have started to get mailed out nationwide. I believe they have until November 29th to cast their secret ballots with the UAW. And then they have until, I think it's November 19th to make sure they're in good standing. You know, that all their dues are paid and they're currently an active member. And they're on active member status because this election is open to all 1 million current and former UAW members. It's not just, there's a lot of UAW members who work across at the Haguish plant in Northwest Indiana. A lot that they march in like the Highland 4th of July parade. You see them do like Habitat for Humanity builds. They've been very active in the community, but they're a significant employer across the Southland and Northwest Indiana. One of the biggest manufacturing operations, and not just the Ford itself, but they have a lot of tier one suppliers in the area, ranging from like Lear and Hammond to you know, multiple employers right outside the plant. They provide not only the parts that go into the vehicles just in time, but they also, like, when the police interceptors are being made, they outfit them, you know, right outside the plant. They, you know, attach all the sirens and lights, all the other police upgrades and things of that nature. But all the members of the UAW, whether at the Ford plants or at some of their suppliers, are going to be able to cast a ballot in this, whether, you know, they can vote directly international leaders going forward, or whether they're going to have to, or whether they would continue to elect their local union delegates, and then the local delegates vote at the constitutional convention to elect the members. So they're, you know, different schools of opinion on, you know, what's for the best, but it's, you know, everybody's able to soon cast their ballot and decide what direction they want the UAW to kind of go in going forward.
Well, Joseph, it sounds like it's going to be another series of stories coming out here when the word finally comes about. Of course, it's going to take a while since you have a million plus people that are going to have to put in their votes by mail. So, but we'll find out later as to what the UAW decides about how they elect their members in the future. We've been talking with Joseph Pete, who's the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, thanks for being with us today, and we hope to have you back on again soon.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Gary Community Schools is a case study in financial freefall. Dwindling enrollment in the Rust Belt city led to declines in state funding, and a few years ago, the district was so broke that Hoosier lawmakers seized control. But suddenly, that's all changed. From Indiana Public Broadcasting, Dylan Pierce McCoy tells us more about the influx of federal COVID relief and what that could mean for the survival of the Gary school system.
Sitting on the bleachers outside Westside Leadership Academy, Nina Burton and a few other Gary parents recalled what it was like to be students in the 1980s.
We had all of the athletics, including swimming. The pool was open because we were forced to take swimming.
So we had all of the athletics.
The Gary Community Schools had close to 30,000 students and several high schools.
We were still one of the top performers.
These days, fewer than 5,000 students attend Gary Community Schools, less than half as many as it had a decade ago. Westside is the only high school in the district. Many of the Geary school buildings are in disrepair. And the pool where Burton took swim lessons is in such poor condition that it's closed.
Lots of our citizens left because things weren't as good as we'd like them to be.
That's Kimberly Kimball, a Geary graduate and parent. Kimball says that because state and federal funding is based on how many students attend,
kind of a catch-22 situation.
But something remarkable happened to Geary schools this year. The district was awarded nearly $68 million through two federal COVID relief bills. That adds up to about $14,000 per student. And in fact, that's just the latest windfall for the district. Last year, a state law extended repayment on $25 million in interest-free loans so Geary schools could improve or demolish buildings. And voters approved a referendum to dramatically increase local funds for schools. Just a few years after the district reached the financial brink, Geary schools now have a nearly balanced budget. Here's Kimball again.
We're really excited about what it's going to mean to really get the money that we should have had.
Paige McNulty is the manager for Geary Schools. During a virtual meeting with state officials, she explains how urgent problems with the buildings have become.
As I'm sitting here in Ms. Martin's office, it's raining inside the office, literally. I'm sitting here watching it roll down the walls.
Indiana lawmakers stripped the local Geary School Board of power in 2017, and a state board now oversees the district. McNulty and her team have not yet publicly shared a detailed plan for the new federal money, but the district has used some to add an hour to each school day and to pay for stipends for staff. The money will also help foot the bill for a massive list of building repairs that includes essential fixes to air conditioning systems and roofs.
I've had to close school twice since I've been here because of building issues. We had to kind of prioritize our huge needs to get moving.
McNulty hopes that repairs to long-neglected athletic facilities like the football field and the pool will attract new students. And remember, more students means more money. There are a few reasons Geary schools struggle with enrollment. The city of Geary has been shrinking for decades as jobs in the steel industry declined and white residents left the community, which is now largely black. At the same time, more than half the public school students in the district boundaries go to charter schools, which are independently managed, or to nearby school systems. It'll be hard to win back some of those parents, like Kimmy Gordon. Gordon enrolled her son in kindergarten before the takeover. Soon after, she decided to withdraw him because the district did not provide the services he needed for his learning disability.
It was just a really challenging experience. It was very disorganized.
Gordon sees improvements in the district, but she's still wary.
I only got one shot at this, and I just can't risk waiting for the Geary Community School to get it together.
Devontae Smith set to kick off for the Cougars.
At a football game in mid-September, LeBaron Burton watches his son from the bleachers. LeBaron is Nina's husband, and the couple have five children. The oldest ones used to attend a local charter school called Thea Bowman Leadership Academy. It's the same school the football team is facing off against today.
First and 10, Westside.
When the Burtons decided to switch to district schools, LeBaron Burton says their children were nervous that they wouldn't be good. But their children have thrived, studying music and playing sports. Sierra Burton is a senior at Westside.
I love going to Geary schools. It might not seem like it, but it's a lot of opportunities you have here.
LeBaron Burton says that for the new money to benefit students for years to come, it must also help the community.
Those funds need to be regenerative.
He wants the school system to hire local plumbers, electricians, and professionals.
One of my concerns is that funding has a way of being recirculated back within the community so that we don't get in this position again later on.
Upgrades to the football field and roof repairs won't remake education in Geary, but residents hope the influx of new money will put the district on closer footing with the surrounding schools that it competes with for students. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Dylan Piers McCoy.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to our guests for being with us. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you on Monday.